I'm joined on the phone by Dr. Joseph Gerson. He is Director of Programs for the American Friends Service Committee's New England Regional Office. He has been playing a leading role in the post-September 11th peace movement and in national and international movements to prevent an invasion of Iraq. He has lectured on campuses and spoken in community events across the U.S. He also serves as the American Friends Service Committee's representative to United for Peace and Justice, the Inclusive and Democratic National Peace Coalition. Dr. Gerson has been active in U.S. justice and peace movements since the mid-60s. He received his undergraduate degree from Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service and his Ph.D. in Politics and International Security Studies from the Union Institute. His work has long focused on building opposition and alternatives to U.S. hegemony, with concentrations on the Middle East, nuclear weapons, and the Asia-Pacific region. He has traveled numerous times to the Middle East and Asia. His books include The Deadly Connection, Nuclear War, and U.S. Intervention, and The Sun Never Sets, Confronting the Network of U.S. Foreign Military Bases, and With Hiroshima Eyes, Atomic War, Nuclear Extortion, and Moral Imagination. It's a pleasure to have you with us, Dr. Joseph Gerson. Hello?
Well, I'm here. If it's possible to turn up or do something with the sound, it would be helpful.
Okay. I'm not sure if I can do that. Maybe I can speak louder. Would that help you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Dr. Gerson, why don't we begin by just talking a little bit about... Okay, you're the director of the Peace and Economic Security Program at the American Friends Service Committee. Can you describe the goal of this program?
Yeah, basically, this is the work done primarily in New England. We work with other programs of AFSC across the United States. Our focus has been essentially on U.S. foreign and military policy and for constructive alternatives to much of what the United States is doing internationally. And if you will, kind of the three foci have been working for nuclear weapons disarmament and abolition, focus on U.S. intervention in the Middle East and in East Asia.
So why don't we talk about one of your books that is most important today in what we're discussing, and that is your book, The Sun Never Sets, Confronting the Network of U.S. Foreign Military Bases. In this book, you basically provide an overview of the global network of army bases, as well as their impacts on the regions that they're in. Can you talk a little bit about that book?
Sure. Actually, its origins may be of interest. This is not something that most of us are aware of, that the United States has a global network of well over 400 military bases and installations. And when I first went to Japan, now better part of 20 years ago, I was amazed to learn that the United States to this day has more than 100 military bases and installations across that country. And to listen to people who, just a real raw pain that people had in terms of the impacts of those bases on their lives, whether it was a sense of shame and humiliation that our country has humongous military bases in their nation's capital, the impacts of night landing exercises in communities, that's airplanes essentially taking off and landing in the middle of the night, leaving people even in the capital of Tokyo with sleepless nights. Or the if you almost the epidemic of sexual harassment, crime, and including rape. And at that meeting, there were also people from the Philippines, and I had been aware of the struggle for national sovereignty in the Philippines to get rid of those bases that essentially had been begun in 1898 with our conquest there, but also in places like Guam and Korea. And I felt that since so little thought was being given to these bases and to these people, that it was important to learn more about it, and that was really the origin of the book. One of the things I found kind of interesting as I was kind of working on this, I had this memory from elementary school, from studying the U.S. Revolution and Declaration of Independence, and I thought, there's something in there about the presence of foreign troops. And I went back and looked at it, and here we're kind of talking about, what are U.S. values at least supposed to be. And sure enough, what it says there is that that King George III kept among us in times of peace, standing armies that committed abuses and usurpations. This was so intolerable that it was necessary to declare independence, and back then it was thought even necessary to initiate war, necessary to kill people. I'm not sure that I would necessarily agree with that. But it helps us maybe to understand what it is that other people experience. One of the things that we know, if you look at it closely, read the fine print in the papers, that one of the declared reasons for the Al-Qaeda attacks on September 11th, 2001, was that the United States has military bases in Arabia, places close to Mecca and Medina. And to try to understand what this means experientially, I asked people to think, what would it be like if we had Chinese military bases, say in Santa Cruz, Washington, D.C., in our national capital, or in the heart of New York City? What would that mean to us in terms of our own sense of self-respect, of our sense of who it was who really made the decisions in the halls of power? And to add to that, in most cases where the U.S. has troops abroad, the U.S. soldiers are not accountable to the legal system of the country where they are. It's a thing called extraterritoriality. So if they are accused or commit crimes, they're not tried by the local court system. And what you find is that in many cases they're not tried at all. And we had most recently in Korea this past summer a case where a tank on exercises ran over two schoolgirls on their way to a birthday party, and they were not tried in the Korean courts. And in the end, the men who were driving the tank were let off, no prison time at all, and nobody was held accountable for the killing of two children. And that, in turn, sparked massive demonstrations and unleashed pent-up anger of more than 50 years.
How did these bases, these 400 U.S. military bases, come to be spread around the world in the first place? I'm sure there's different reasons in different areas, but...
Right. In each area, it kind of has grown over time. So you have the beginning of this overseas military empire really in the 1890s, beginning with a military base in Hawaii. I have a memory from being at Georgetown all these many years ago of our professor, who actually was the principal ghostwriter of John Kennedy's book, Profiles in Courage. And I remember him talking about the 1890s. It was a period of massive economic depression and dislocation here in the United States, growing unions, opposition, social turmoil, and both business and leaders were seeking ways to try to create stability. And what they saw was the China market, the idea that if we could gain access to and control the China market, we could export goods and have jobs here at home. Well, in order to do that trade, in those days, the trade was done by ships fueled by coal. And coal could, ships could only go but so far before they had to take on more fuel. So what you needed to have was a structure of, if you will, bases across islands. So we kind of pushed west, and this was really why the United States went to war, against the Philippines. I mean, against Spain, against the Philippines. So in that war, we conquer Cuba and Puerto Rico, and really turned the Caribbean into an American lake. And then similarly in Asia, remember this man's descriptions of Subic Bay, pointing to it on the map. It's a perfect jumping off point for controlling China, a deep, round, perfect harbor, which when I finally saw it, I absolutely understood. And so we held on to that. We kept Philippines as a colony through 1948. And then after that, although it had nominal independence, it was still functionally a U.S. colony. And we held on to those bases formally until 1991. And now while we no longer have immediate control of those bases, we have what's called visiting forces agreement, whereby U.S. forces can go essentially anywhere in the Philippines. With Japan, basically we had some more bases slowly during the period leading up to World War II, but not so much. But in the aftermath of World War II, essentially we're taking on the British and French empires. We're integrating much of their imperial. But we're also conquering much of Western Europe and Japan, Korea, and basically went in, used as military bases as well as other things, but basically held that ground with the U.S. military bases. So to this day, you have more than, again, 100 bases, not only in Japan, but also in Korea. And until recently, their entire military on a day-to-day basis was run and controlled by the U.S. military. And we had military dictatorships there, as was the case essentially in the Philippines. When we wanted to overthrow a government, basically we gave the orders that allowed the Korean soldiers to move. If we didn't favor a particular coup, then the soldiers didn't get the freedom to move. And again, in Europe, to this day we have nuclear weapons based in England and in Holland, and we have bases across Western Europe. And one of the things that's been happening since this fall, especially as the German government has opposed the U.S. war in the Middle East, the U.S. is moving its structure of bases further to the east in Europe. So we now have bases in places like Hungary and Bulgaria and the Baltic states. So this is, and it's really the title of the book, "The Sun Never Sets," is obviously a play on the British expression, "The Sun Never Sets," on the British Empire, and this is the case with our bases. In the Middle East, it's an interesting kind of history. We, again, kind of post-World War II, we had a structure of bases, some in Arabia, some in Libya, but kind of holding our power there to a degree. But the British still held on with bases so-called east of Suez, Suez being the Suez Canal. But the real change comes with the Nixon Doctrine, where we during the Nixon era, basically U.S. forces were concentrated in Indochina as there was challenges to U.S. control of oil in the Middle East. What the U.S. did was to find local client regimes like the Shah in Iran, sell them some of the most modern military equipment possible, and basically let them rule for us. And this model essentially came to an end with the Iranian Revolution in 1979, the rise of Islamic forces there. And out of that, you have essentially two U.S. responses. One is the Carter Doctrine, in which we say that any threat to our interests there will be met with U.S. power and all means necessary. When you're a nuclear power and you say all means necessary, that includes the possibility of U.S. First strike attack. The other thing was we created was called the Rapid Deployment Force, now the Central Command, and began accelerating the construction of bases across the region, in Egypt, in Somalia at the time, in Arabia, and now we have a rather huge structure of bases across the Middle East. And the idea, is, as the New York Times reported a week ago, is to integrate Iraq into this and essentially transform Iraq into an unsinkable aircraft carrier, which can be used against Iran to the east, can be used against Syria, and is a lever against Saudi Arabia to the south. The one area I haven't talked about is, I haven't talked that much about Latin America or Africa, but the other area really to focus on is Central Asia, where we had no bases. I mean, most of that area was part of the Soviet Union. But with the war in Afghanistan, we now have a structure of bases in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and this functions to help the encirclement of China, which the U.S. sees as a strategic competitor for the long term, and also with bases now in Iraq, in circles Iran. So you have this global structure that's really designed to reinforce empire.
In any of these areas that you're talking about, where there are U.S. military bases, are they welcomed? You described in your book that there was a lot of public opposition to it for numerous reasons, including...
I think in each country it's a bit different. I mean, at the moment, the U.S. is being welcomed in by Bulgaria and by Hungary, where I think the bases are seen as, on the one hand, a hedge against the possible rise of the of Russia again. And where there's, I think, stronger feelings of affinity for the United States on the other side of the Cold War. In Kuwait, basically, they didn't have a whole lot of choice. I mean, the U.S. Went in and drove the Iraqis back, and quid pro quo was that much of the country could be used as a military base. Japan is an interesting case where... we had a military occupation beginning in 1945, and as that was drawing to a close in 1951, the United States essentially gave the emerging leadership an offer. Either the occupation could continue, or we could have a peace treaty, but as a central element of that peace treaty, the U.S., that they would have to sign a peace treaty with the United States, called the not only the peace treaty but also a military bases agreement, done in secret actually. And so the U.S. had enormous power even after the occupation, and that treaty was designed to explicitly to run out in 1960. And as the politics, most Japanese didn't want the bases to continue. There were huge protests against it. But the U.S. literally took a man who had been a Class A war criminal, nurtured by the CIA, made him prime minister. And with him as prime minister, they essentially rammed through the continuation of this military alliance. And this is really the foundation for U.S. bases to this day. There are certainly some in Japan who have appreciated the U.S. military umbrella, nuclear umbrella, during the Cold War, and who are concerned that if the U.S. was not there militarily, that they would be facing China alone. But the downside of this is that they've essentially lost their independence. And what the United States has done through this period has been to essentially allow the reemergence of many of the forces who really were behind, historical forces and literal people who were behind the Japanese imperialism of the 30s and 40s. So to this day, they in their school textbooks, they don't deal with the aggression that Japan committed against Korea or against China or much of Asia. It's called an advance. The Japanese haven't faced their history because it hasn't served either the United States or this elite that we've put in place. So it really kind of varies from country to country what the particulars are. But in almost every case, while the elite may support it, what it is that people at the ground level have to deal with, that's something else again. And there's a woman named Cynthia Enloe, who teaches at a university here in Massachusetts, and has written a book called The Bananas, Bases, and Beaches, kind of looking at foreign military policy through the lens of feminism. And what you see is that there's a gendered dimension to the presence of military bases in every case. Women suffer their presence much more than men. And also the opposition, and much of what we have come to know about bases around the world, really has come through both the suffering and the resistance of women because of the proximity of the bases.
And you're tuned to 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm speaking with Joseph Gerson. He's Director of Programs for the American Friends Service Committee's New England Regional Office. Dr. Gerson has been active in U.S. justice and peace movement since the mid-60s. He has a Ph.D. in politics. He has traveled numerous times to the Middle East and Asia, and he has three books, including the one we're discussing, The Sun Never Sets, Confronting the Network of U.S. Foreign Military Bases. Dr. Gerson, what are the purpose of these 400 bases around the world, U.S. military bases? Are they for self-defense, defense of our allies?
Bottom line, they're about maintenance of an empire. The United States is long past the period of, if you will, self-defense. We have a military budget at this point that's equal to the next 30 biggest military spenders in the world combined. We talk about our interests in the Middle East, those interests being essentially control of the oil of the region. And control of the oil in that region, it's not that we consume much of that oil here in the United States, but it provides us a lever of power over Europe and over East Asia, whose societies are dependent on that oil. I think consistently, the U.S. project has been essentially the building of an empire, and these bases are an important part of how we maintain it. It's interesting. During the Cold War period, were you to use the language of imperialism or empire, you would be marginalized as a extreme leftist. Although there were a few people, including Zbigniew Brzezinski of the Carter administration, who at least in their writings were willing to address that language. But one of the interesting things that's happened, I think, especially since 9/11. Has been in the popular press, in academia, among the neoconservatives, a willingness, in fact, a perceived necessity of using the language in the frames of reference of empire and imperialism. If you look in today's New York Times Magazine, there's an article by Niall Ferguson, an English neoconservative with huge influence here in the United States, essentially saying that the United States is an empire, and we need to be more conscious about that and to run it like a real empire if it's going to persist. And, of course, much of the rest of the world is looking at the U.S. empire aghast and are very concerned about what this means for global security. In a sense, many in this country have become, if you will, intoxicated with military power, intoxicated with a kind of imperialism that is going to cost the U.S. people dearly over the long term. It's already costing us in terms of our economy, and will much more so in coming years. And it's basically the Cold War ended largely on the basis of a concept that wasn't empire. And it's inherently anti-imperialist. It was of common security. The idea that no nation can be secure if its neighbors or others who were in conflict with it felt insecure. When you have that situation, you have a spiraling arms race, or in the case of, say, the United States and much of the Arab and Islamic worlds, a struggle of power which can be of conventional weapons and then asymmetric attacks. As our empire has increased, so has our insecurity. And there are ways in which we can move toward common security at military levels, in terms of economics, in terms of culture, that can allow others in the nation, in the world, to feel more secure, and therefore to allow us to feel more secure. That means some changes in the way we have our foreign policy. It means some changes in the way we look at the rest of the world.
You mentioned the language of imperialism. Can you give me some more examples, when you say that you're speaking about the press in this country and our quote-unquote leaders that are using this language of imperialism? Can you give me some more examples?
Sure. One of the remarkable things took place last, I guess, in the fall. Again, a cover story in the New York Times. Huge letters. U.S. Empire, and then the smaller lettering was "Get Used to It," and an article essentially trying to educate readers of the New York Times that we are an empire and we need to get used to it. There's a book out now. I think it's on the bestseller list, which is you know, certainly much the rage among conservatives and. Conservative is actually the wrong word. I mean, they're really military radicals. But among the right wing in this country, it's called "Of Power and Paradise," written by Robert Kagan. And here he's really quite clear that the explicit that the U.S. Project here is imperialist, and is essentially saying that while we had this in common with Europe in the past. Europe is now moving to a vision of international law, of respect for treaties, and the United States is dealing much more in terms of power. And with the power we have, we can really ignore Western Europe as we pursue our imperial project. There's a good body of literature which really came out in initially, or at least I became aware of it. In the 1960s, there was a school of historians called revisionist historians, led by a man named William Appleman Williams, who taught it at the University of Wisconsin and was for a period the head of the American Historical Association, really kind of looking at the origins of empire, you know, not in an angry way, but just kind of looking at the evolution of this country. Going back to what were the models of the men at the Constitutional Convention as they were envisioning what the U.S. government should become. And their models were, understandably, Greece and Rome and the British and French and Spanish empires. You have the creation of a continental empire some of if you will, the law of unintended consequences. So, for example, after the Civil War, the veterans were given 40 acres and a mule to settle what had been the Louisiana Purchase in the West. Well, those 40 acres and a mule, they grew a lot of food. And what happened was that they grew so much food that the price of wheat and corn collapsed, leaving them desperate. So they, in turn, began demanding foreign markets. So some of the origins here come from really the farmers and agrarian classes saying, we need markets in Latin America, we need markets in Asia. And even before that, you had we all study in school, the Monroe Doctrine. Well, what was the Monroe Doctrine? The Monroe Doctrine, 1823. The United States is telling Europe, keep out of the Americas. They're ours. This is our sphere of influence. You have nothing to do with it. If that's not imperialist, I don't know what is. So this is kind of the emergence of that history. And as I say, there's quite a body of very fine history that just records what it was that took place.
Now, the Bush-Cheney-Rumsfeld military doctrine basically seeks to guarantee that the U.S. has the, quote, military capability to act at any time, anywhere, in defense of what it sees as its global interests. Can you talk a little bit about the Bush-Cheney-Rumsfeld military doctrine, and how do U.S. military bases fit into that doctrine?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, this is a really good question. One of the things that, you know, the people who work on these issues, like myself, were following this, you know, in the period of the elections, and, you know, could read what Condoleezza Rice was writing in Foreign Affairs in terms of, you know, really concern only about the U.S. national interest, and had some glimmer of where they wanted to go. It's interesting, before September 11th, I think it's in the July 5th, 2001 issue of the New Yorker. There's a man named Nicholas Lehman, who's a journalist, been writing very good things, and he's had tremendous access to the Bush administration. And in this article, he describes an interview with Cheney, and he asked Cheney. He said, "Is there a single organizing dynamic at play in the world today?" And Cheney's response is, "Well, yes, there is." We're in the process of preparing to impose the arrangement for the 21st century, which will guarantee that the United States continues to be the dominant political, military, and economic power in the world. Now, it's interesting. If one of the things I've experienced in talking to a lot of U.S. Audiences is when you talk about U.S. dominance, it's something that we tend to take for granted, and it just grows all the way out of the origins of this country with the with the Pilgrims and the idea of creating a city on the hill, and the answers lie here. But it's interesting if you in U.S. military policy, growing even from the Clinton administration, the doctrine itself is called full spectrum dominance, which means being able to dominate any nation, any conflict, at any level of conflict, whether it's rifles or Star Wars. But if you turn that around for a minute, and you think, what does it mean to be full spectrum dominated? If you are a French foreign minister, if you're a Colombian economics minister, if you're a engineer in Nigeria, to be full spectrum dominated every day of the week, every week of the year, it's something that does not win us friends over the long term. So that's a bit of context. These people, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and others, as they're coming to power, they were very explicit about who their models were, saying that their models were people like Teddy Roosevelt, Admiral Mahan, and Henry Cabot Lodge. They also mentioned Frederick the Great of Prussia. And what Lodge and Roosevelt and Mahan did in the 1890s was to be able to see clearly the possibility that the U.S. could become the world's dominant power, replacing Britain. They envisioned the kind of navy we would need to have in order to do that, and they set about building it. Very, very, very clear that their ambition was imperial. And what Rumsfeld and Cheney and the others have been doing has been to try to reconsolidate U.S. Military dominance, really for the coming decades. So you see it in the drive for so-called missile defenses, which are really designed to, on the one hand, open the wedge for monopolizing the militarization of space, and also to provide a shield which makes it safer for us to fight first-strike nuclear war. You have the removal of the ABM treaty. You have the rejection, really, of considerable international law, the attack on the United Nations, really trying to move to break out of really a culture of international treaties, of the United Nations, and moving to this period of dominance. We also had back in last September, as they're preparing for the war against Iraq, basically two papers that came out. One is the Nuclear Posture Review, which commits the United States to nuclear dominance and superiority for decades to come. Talks about preemptive nuclear attack. Talks about first strike nuclear attack. And then you have the National Strategy Doctrine, which is really a kind of a updating of what we had in the first Bush administration. And remember, the first Bush administration, which we think of as being comparatively kind and gentle compared to this one, their expressed doctrine for the first Gulf War was to create a new world order, quote unquote, in which, quote, what we say goes. And what we see is the effort to kind of impose that now. So the National Strategy Doctrine says that we will remain the world's dominant power, preemptive war, it's in total violation of the UN Charter. That will use nuclear weapons even against non-nuclear nations, and so on. And the other, maybe the most central piece is to say we will even do preemptive attacks against potential rivals, not necessarily global rivals, but even regional rivals, as they are building their power. This is the kind of thing that makes the Chinese very, very afraid and perhaps rightfully paranoid of the United States.
So this attitude and this doctrine, this behavior goes way back. It's not just something that stemmed from September 11th, the attacks of September 11th, 2001.
Well, this approach of these people certainly does precede it, and you know, a number of the cultural antecedents are, as I indicated, you know, go back a couple of hundred years. What I believe is that this administration really has explored, not only me, I mean, I think many people around the world, you'll remember that this government's response to September 11th has just really been exploitation. You know, there was, if you'll remember, after those attacks, really global sympathy with the United States. The United States, really could do almost anything there for a period of months, and the world was quite willing to tolerate it as this retaliation coming out of this pain. But what you see is that under the cover of this, they have increased U.S. military spending by more than $100 billion a year. That's like twice the military budget of any nation in the world. We have walked out of the ABM Treaty. We've undermined the Biological Warfare Convention, attempted to subvert the International Criminal Court. And with this war against Iraq, gone to war in violation of the United Nations Charter. This is the kind of thing that makes the rest of the world kind of not only stand back with a sense of anxiety, but has in fact begun to create what's called a countervailing system of power. So you've got the French and the Germans and the Russians beginning to resist, and much of the rest of the world being really quite sympathetic to what they're doing. And one other thing that's kind of interesting, and I think, how to say it, I mean, after 9/11, and with these kind of heavy dependence on militarism to respond to it, rather than police work within the Constitution, thoughtful use of intelligence. And diplomacy, which is what the rest of the world has generally used against terrorism. People in many countries, I mean, leaders, diplomats, have viewed our leaders as literally being mad, as being crazy, and believing that they are really overreaching in ways that will inevitably lead to some sort of crash and collapse. With the sense that they'll pick up the pieces on the other side. The question is how much damage gets done between here and there. And I think in part this is how the rest of the world is responding to the United States. It's interesting, in the last few weeks in Europe, people are beginning to talk about other ways that they can contain U.S. power non-militarily. People, you know, we have a massive deficit. This deficit is what makes it possible, among other things, to maintain this huge military machine and to conduct these aggressions. And powerful people in Europe and elsewhere are beginning to say, you know, if we sell our dollars and invest only in euros, the value of the dollar will go down. That will hurt Bush. That may wake the Americans up. Maybe they should, they're saying, begin to withdraw their investments in U.S. bonds, which would make it that much more difficult for us to finance our deficit and send a powerful message to us here. So these are ways in which the rest of the world is attempting to say no. I mean, there's a sense of absolute, you know, both a combination of amazement and outrage, as essentially our Pentagon is ruling Iraq now. It wouldn't even let the State Department have significant influence, let alone the United Nations or European partners. It's really quite a unique moment we've entered into.
And you're tuned to 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm speaking with Joseph Gerson. He's Director of Programs for the American Friends Service Committee's New England Regional Office. He has lectured on campuses and spoken in community events across the U.S. Dr. Gerson has been active in U.S. justice and peace movement since the mid-60s. He has a Ph.D. in politics, and he has traveled numerous times to the Middle East and to Asia. He has three books, including The Sun Never Sets, Confronting the Network of U.S. Foreign Military Bases. I have just a few more questions for you, Dr. Gerson. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. In a speech that you gave I believe in Korea, right before, yes, in South Korea, right before the September 11th in August of 2001, you talked about, one of the things you talked about was the Rumsfeld Pentagon's new announcement of its new U.S. doctrine that had four military priorities. Again, this is before September 11th, 2001, attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. In its public statements, this is a quote from your speech, the Rumsfeld Pentagon has announced that the new U.S. doctrine has four military priorities. One, ostensible defense of U.S. territory. Two, making other nations, quote, afraid of possible U.S. military actions, especially in the Asia-Pacific, in Europe, and in the Middle East. Three, to, quote, win decisively, unquote, in one major conflict, while it, four, conducts, quote, small-scale contingencies of limited duration in other areas of the world. While the doctrine is global in scope, it shifts the focus of U.S. military planning and power from Europe to the Asia-Pacific region. It seems like this has panned out since September 11th, and it almost makes me question if this was something that was planned well before September 11th. It's pretty clear that it was. Also, you have, for example, the Project for a New American Century.
Right.
Saying things such as, we need another Pearl Harbor-type attack to galvanize the public behind this kind of dominance doctrine. So some people wonder if this administration may have either allowed the September 11th attacks to happen so they could use them to advance their policy, or if they might have had some involvement themselves. And I wonder what your attitude on this is.
Well, it's the kind of thing that is, it is such, if it is true, it would be, you know, so mind-bogglingly atrocious that my approach is that unless there is, and until there is absolutely decisive evidence that it's true, there's no reason to, you know, for those who are critical of the administration to be bringing it forward. It would be such an infamous act to have done that. And my approach is to say that what the Bush administration has done is sufficiently, as diplomats who have resigned in protest have said, so much in violation both of our values and of our interests that we're, I think, really quite safe to be able to talk on those grounds. I hope that people will continue to investigate in this area, but I don't have any smoking guns on it, and so I'm really reluctant to, you know, to base much of what I say on that.
Well, what I'm getting at is, it just seems like even if they had no involvement, at the very least they may have allowed this to occur, because it just seems almost too blatant, the statements that were made beforehand by the neocons that are now running the administration. Yeah. It just seems almost too much of a coincidence that they could not have known ahead of time that this may happen and manipulated it for their own advantage.
Well, I would certainly agree with the latter part. They clearly have manipulated it to their own advantage and really to move us far from any moorings of a democratic society. I think, you know, one of the actually, on September 11th, as we were building a coalition here in the Boston area that afternoon, one of the principal commitments we made was to be working to defend our constitutional rights as well as those who we understood would be most at risk here in the United States, meaning Arab Americans, Arab South Asians, and Muslims. But I guess my sense is that they've exploited it. They had their agendas beforehand, but I'm not sure that they needed this in order to move with it. It gave them an opening which they've exploited. I think we can point to, look at the number of people who are unemployed. Look at the increasing insecurity we have from lack of medical care. Look at what's happening really across our country in state after state, where the governments can't meet their budgets, and essential social services are being withdrawn. With the increased deficit spending, this is going to have to be paid not only by my generation, but by several generations to come, reducing really their life opportunities. I think we can struggle on these very real, plus just the brutality of what the United States is doing internationally and unnecessarily. I mean, you know, where are these weapons of mass destruction? How what a great danger they were to the United States as we walk through Iraq and then can't find them anywhere, and the rest of the world watches this. It alienates us from the rest of the world. I think we can argue on what we know and what we can absolutely document. I don't think we have to go to areas where we're conjecturing possibilities, which, if in time they do prove true, should lead to rather more than the impeachment of these people.
Let's talk a little bit about Iraq. How long does the United States plan to be in Iraq, and what will our function be there? Are we planning on putting in permanent military bases in Iraq?
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a story, at several levels to respond to this. There was a story last Sunday in the New York Times in which high-level people in the military were essentially quoted as saying the U.S. planned to build permanent bases in four portions of Iraq, and that caused quite a stir. With the massive protests against the U.S. presence that began almost from the time we got there. I mean, a million people went to the city of Karbala as part of the Shiite pilgrimage. In a country of 24 million people, we're talking about essentially 1 out of 10 adults went there. I mean, that's staggering. And many of them went saying, yes, we're glad that Saddam Hussein is not here, and now America, get out. In this context, saying that we're going to come in with military bases, that's putting fuel on the fire. And so Rumsfeld moved quickly to say, well, this is premature to talk about this, and it's not helpful. Interesting language. It's premature, and it's not helpful. Yesterday, he said that the United States will remain in both Iraq and Afghanistan as long as it takes to create democratic governments there. It's going to take decades to create a democratic government in Iraq, if at all. That, to me, was a very interesting signal that we'll be there in one form or another, probably for decades. I think this is their ambition. We certainly have to be there militarily in order to ensure that a government that is to our liking comes to power and to protect it for a number of years. And I think very much like the Japan model, and they signaled this to us, the quid pro quo for reducing our presence there is likely to be an ongoing military presence. It doesn't necessarily have to be, say, 5 or 7 years from now, if they're successful, of what's called a permanent military base. It can be an access agreement, which is like what we have for the Philippines now, where we essentially build a base. We have pre-positioned materials there, a very small number of people there. But in a crisis period, we can bring in thousands of people to use it as a launching pad for a war against Saudi Arabia or Iran or Syria or anybody else. So I think that's the model. They plan to be there a very long time.
Dr. Gerson, we've gone over a little bit. Do you mind if I ask you just a couple more questions, or do you need to be on your way?
Okay.
A couple more?
Okay. Let's go two more, and then we'll call it.
Okay.
I'm not adept at giving short answers, so I haven't made it easy for you, I'm sure.
That's okay. In some of your speeches, you have referred to, quote, the Bush administration's global military crusade of overt and covert warfare in as many as 60 to 80 nations. Is our government really involved in that many countries, and if so, how?
Well, this is actually a quotation, actually putting together a couple quotations from statements made by the Bush administration in the initial months after the war began. And you see, I mean, there was Bush's State of the Union speech this last January, where he talked about a number of people who caused us problems who, we don't need to talk about what happened to them. That's not the precise quote, but he basically let us know that a number of people have been killed covertly in a number of places. They're both in the war against al-Qaeda and more widely. I mean, we're moving once again toward confrontation with North Korea. They're looking at a global military crusade. One of the things that's interesting about Rumsfeld is his love affair with special operations forces. And we have, you know, more and more of them playing a role that was once played by the CIA. So I mean, their vision is Genghis Khan would recognize it. So would the people who led the Japanese military state. One of really global domination. This is what they're about, and they're willing to fight it any way that they find necessary. At the same time, I think they're, you know, Karl Rove is a bright boy, and I think they're going to want to try to avoid war, a major war, say between now and the 2004 election, so they can concentrate on the economy. But their confrontational approach with North Korea could make things interesting.
Dr. Gerson, one final question for you. There are many Americans that would feel secure and safe knowing that we have 400 U.S. military bases scattered around the globe, and this would make them feel more secure. There are many people who would say, well, we have good intentions, and, you know, this, the fact that the U.S. government and military is dominant in the world is a good thing, because can you imagine if we weren't, who would be? What would you say to people who feel that way to convince them that, in fact, this global network of U.S. Army bases is a problem, as you argue in some of your writings and books and lectures?
Well, it's a really good question. I think it's where a lot of the dialogue needs to take place in this country, because we've sort of become accustomed to dominance. I think the two points that I would stress are one, that this is absolutely in contradiction with our values. To maintain this structure of military bases, we have to support military dictatorships. We have to support governments like Saudi Arabia and the Pakistani dictatorship, or Uzbekistan, which are absolutely repressive of their own people. And this really goes against, I think, the fundamental commitment we have to democracy and to self-determination, which is really the foundation of our society. I would argue that that's actually in danger and jeopardy at this point, but that's our fundamental values, and that's what people even on the right say that they favor. And then I would point to some very immediate self-interest approaches to it. One has to do with the fact that this dominance breeds resistance. It alienates us from the rest of the world. And so whether it's terrorist attacks, as we experienced on September 11th, directly related to the bases, or whether it's threats of economic punishment, boycotts and others, it's not really in our security interests to be maintaining this. And it's not something that benefits most of us. It benefits perhaps the military-industrial complex. It benefits the oil companies. It doesn't benefit people on a day-to-day basis. And then the last thing I would point to in terms of self-interest has to do with all those social services which are essential to our security. I mean, what does it mean to have security if you can't get medical care? What does it mean to have security if you are homeless? I mean, what does it mean to have security if you don't have a pension at the end of a working life? I mean, this is not security. It's massive insecurity. And all of these things could be paid for were we to have a more democratic approach to the rest of the world. And as I said earlier, I think the conceptual frame of reference that we can be building a more secure world around is one of common security. The idea that we value not only our security, but the security of other people's, and let us all be on a rising tide.
Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Joseph Gerson. Can you just conclude by telling us where people can get more information, website?
Any other? A couple of places you can go. One is to the website of the American Friends Service Committee, www.afsc.org. And my own program's webpage is www.afsc.org/PES, for Peace and Economic Security, .htm, as in Mary.
Thank you so much.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.
Have a good evening.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And you're tuned to 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz. I was just speaking with Dr. Joseph Gerson. He's Director of Programs for American Friends Service Committee's New England Regional Office. He has been playing a leading role in the post-September 11th peace movement and in national and international movements to prevent an invasion of Iraq. He has lectured on campuses and spoken in community events across the United States. He also serves as the AFSC's representative to United for Peace and Justice, the Inclusive and Democratic National Peace Coalition. Dr. Gerson has been active in U.S. justice and peace movements since the mid-60s. He has a Ph.D. in politics. He has traveled numerous times to the Middle East and to Asia. His work has long focused on building opposition and alternatives to U.S. hegemony with concentrations on the Middle East, nuclear weapons, and the Asia-Pacific region. His books include The Deadly Connection, Nuclear War and U.S. Intervention, The Sun Never Sets, Confronting the Network of U.S. Foreign Military Bases, and With Hiroshima Eyes, Atomic War, Nuclear Extortion, and Moral Imagination. And again, if you want to check out the American Friends Service Committee's website, it's AFSC for American Friends Service Committee, AFSC.org. And more specifically, Dr. Gerson's website is www.afsc.org/pes.htm. That is afsc.org/pes.htm. You can read some of his speeches there, some of his articles, as well as a lot of other interesting things. There's videos available through the website. There's other folks' speeches and articles and kind of their mission statement there and some of their upcoming events and activities. And it's a great website. Again, afsc.org/pes.htm.